Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. It's really nice to have you come for the book of Obadiah. I can't tell you, I always wonder, it's like, is anybody going to show up? And thank you so much. I do enjoy looking into these things. As I look at it, you know, I'm uncovering stuff. It's not like I'm familiar with the book of Obadiah just because, you know, I teach the Bible. You know, I plow through things, read things, and it just kind of keeps growing. And there's so many other connections that come together. I got a map right here. It's on your notes, but this is Edom, is this area right down in here. Some things. This is the Negev. Is in the south. This is really a desert. It's like a wilderness area right in here. Solomon had conquered, or David had conquered, and Solomon ended up using Ezion Geber right here Geber. I thought that was Geber. Yeah, there's a G there. Ezion Geber. From ships, when he was making connections with other countries and shipping things in, this was one of his seaports. So Solomon was sailing. We're not sure how far he went, but he kind of occupied this. And there's even signs of the things that he did down there in archaeology. This is like a ridge right in here, rising up this way. Mountains are out in this area. There's a desert right here. The Arabian Desert starts on this side of the mountain. So right here's that mountain range. This is a place called Selah in the Old Testament. It means rock, because these are these are rocky mountains, not like the Rocky Mountains, but they're you know, rocks that they're going to carve in. And this is going to become Petra. This is the same site. Selah means rock in Hebrew. Petra means rock in Greek. And so when you start talking about Petra, like you go see Petra today, it means rock, and Selah is the Hebrew word, and then Teman is one of the capital cities. There's a river coming right in here, running out of these mountains, draining into the Dead Sea, going this way, of course. And that's the land of Edom. It would go south and moving this way up in that area. Now, some interesting things that, you know, we kind of picking up from last week, another connection. I got in the middle of that notes right there, the history of the fall of Edom, because this book, the first 16 verses is about the coming destruction. And so historically, how does this take place? Well, in 586, this book is about, again, there's several options on when this book is, when they're referring to what events. But the most obvious and the best guess, and we can show you some other examples right from the Bible, is 586 when Nebuchadnezzar came in and destroyed Jerusalem or overran Judah, this area up in here, including the Negev, because that was part of a land of Judah. Now, Marilyn, I'm thinking when we were in the Negev, when we went down to Beersheba, we were driving through the Negev and just that barren land. Sometimes you see camels, you know, out and around, and just people, you know, herdsmen just standing in the wilderness there with their sheep or their camels. And just it's pretty barren, although they make it work. Now, by 525, remember, Nebuchadnezzar didn't come down. He took Ammon and Moab and Judah, and he did not take Edom. Edom was kind of left alone. But by 525 B.C., so within this short of time, we think Obadiah, that's what I'm presenting, is Obadiah is written shortly after 586, because Edom would have sided with Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. But by 525, Nabataean Arabs had taken over the Edomite capital of Selah right here. So by the Nabataean Arabs lived out towards the wilderness or the desert over here. They'd come through the mountains and they had taken over. By 525, this is an Arab city, no longer Edom. So sometime during this period right here, probably like we had talked about before, 539, when Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon, he wanted access to this trade route, and he probably supported the Arabs driving the Edomites out. And the Edomites then fled up into the Negev. The survivors, they moved up into the Negev into Judah territory that had been abandoned because of 586 while they were in Babylon. And so that's the next point. The area in southern Judah was called Idumea by the Greeks after Alexander came. So this Idumea, in the Negev right here, the Edomites, the survivors of the Edomites, are going to become, they go to this land called, I got to spell it correctly, Idumea, I-D-U, Idumea, and that's going to, that we're not done. We're not done with this. And you know this part of the story. It's going to catch up. It's the Christmas story. It's coming right here. So this land of the Edomites became Idumea, and that's what the Greeks and the Romans began to call them. When the Romans came after the Greeks, so you got the Babylonians, the Persians, and then the Greeks driving them out. Now, when the Romans come in, they let these survivors, or the land of Idumea, they had their own nation, kind of took their own territory in the Negev. They kind of let them rule it. And that's what the Romans would do. They would come in and they'd conquer a place, and they don't want to change anything necessarily. They just want, you know, your territory, your taxes, and if you've got a religion, you've got a government, you can keep peace, carry on. But if you can't, then Rome will come in and they'll establish peace for you. Well, they let the Idumeans rule. And a guy named Antipater, an Idumean, or an Edomite, Antipater became the king of Idumea, and the Romans let him. And he had a couple sons. One was Herod the Great, who was given the control of Galilee, while Antipater controlled this area for the Romans. So as long as Antipater could control it, the Romans are letting him do it. And Antipater put Herod up in charge of Galilee. And so Herod is an Idumean, and there's no doubt Herod was then an Edomite. So there they move up here into the Negev. They begin to rule their own little territory here. The Romans recognize them. Antipater, Herod's father, is poisoned, and Herod then hunts down the conspirators, and the Romans give him the kingdom of Judea from Idumea all the way up to Galilee. They give it to Herod the Great, and Herod the Great rules and does an outstanding job of being a leader, a king, with buildings and organization, and ruled for years. Of course, he's very cruel and very protective of his reign. Interestingly, just to throw this in, when the Maccabees fought the Greeks and they had the Maccabean revolt and they went back and cleansed the land and got rid of the Greeks, so the Greeks are trying to get rid of the scriptures and were trying to prevent them from following the law and preventing the Jews from practicing circumcision. And the Maccabees, they rose up, the Hasmoneans, and drove them out, and they took over. Well, then the Hasmoneans, or the Maccabean family, they come from the line of priests called the Hasmoneans, or the Hasmoneans, and they became the kings. So you have a period there where the family of the Maccabees ruled Jerusalem as priests, but also as kings, not in the line of Judah, just kind of under between the Greeks and the Romans. So you've got the Hasmoneans ruling. They were so zealous for the law, because that's what they'd fought for, to preserve the law, that they went down and they forced the Edomites to become Jews. In other words, they came down and forced them to go through circumcision, and the Idumeans were forced by the Hasmoneans to join them in their religion, because again they're expanding the kingdom there. And that's where Herod comes out of. Then Antipater comes up out of the Idumeans, and Herod comes up. And so basically, for your Christmas story, Esau is going to produce the line of Herods. Jacob is going to produce the Christ. I mean, that's right. That goes from Genesis right down to the Christmas story. It was Esau versus Jacob in your Christmas story. And so that's that whole thing right there. And that you can see that I got that written down there. The fourth bullet point, the Idumeans, after the time of Christ, during the days of the New Testament, joined the Jews in their revolt against Rome. They joined the revolt in 68 AD. The Jews began in 66. Idumeans joined it in 68 AD, and then, of course, were wiped out along with the Jews in 70 AD. That they were then, scattered, dispersed, slaughtered or dispersed among the nations. And in 70 AD, that's the last we hear of the Idumeans. So the Edomites are there in 586, helping the Nebuchadnezzar. By 525, the Edomites have been forced up, survivors have been forced up into the Negev. The Nabataeans have come into here, the traders, the Arabs, they're called Arabs, and they're in this area. And now the Edomites basically morph into the Idumean country, and they're Edomites. And and then they join with the Jewish revolt against Rome and are destroyed. So you can see that's how they fall. You've got something happening with Nabonidzar. You have the Arabs coming in by 525. They've lost their capital city. And if you turn that page of the notes, that's Petra. The picture on the right, now these are not my pictures. I had a chance to go to Jordan and go down through this, and I passed it up back in 2007. And obviously, now that you know I'm standing here, it's like, why didn't you go? Anyway, let's not talk about that. So I don't have any pictures. But you see that the picture on the right, that is this area right here, the mountain range right there. It's the rocks. It's just very high, lofty places. That's why it's going to talk about the stars and eagles and being high and how no one could get to them because they lived up in there. It was really a barren land in a sense, except for these rock formations, and it was very easy to defend. And they lived, basically, they were very independent. The word pride is going to come up because they were a very independent, proud people that didn't need anyone. They could survive alone. They're your basic, the Edomites were your basic, well, look at Esau, a man of the wilderness. They were your basic, you know, the survivors. You know, they're out there on their own. They've got their own ammunition. They make their own food, make their own beef jerky. You know, they're out there. They can survive. And that's who they were. And they were proud of it. And that's going to come up. They not only did they not need anybody else, they didn't need God. They had their own ways. But nonetheless, that's what it looks like. But then the picture on the left is Petra. That's right here at Selah. Right here, or means rock. Now, that was not cut by Edomites, and there's a hole that they carved into the rocks, into those hills, those mountains, homes, cities. I mean, they didn't just cut, you know, caves. They would cut, you know, you can see it's got like, it looks like woodworking. And so there are very elaborate homes cut into the rocks. You can imagine how cool they would be or how warm they would be. I mean, the temperature change would be very stable. That was cut by the Nabataeans, the Arabs, coming out of the desert when they came up and they took this from the Edomites and drove the Edomites out. That's when Petra was cut. So we can't say Esau's descendants cut that. The people that drove Edom out were the ones that cut Petra. And that would be, you know, after, you know, the times of the Greeks and the Romans but during that time period. So that's a little more background on that. On top of those pictures, I got two things, just information. Interestingly, besides talking about the major world powers like Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Edom has more mentions in the Bible than any other nation. We're talking about hostile mentions, meaning they're like the Babylonians were against the Jews and the Assyrians were against the Jews. Edom is mentioned. You can see how many we read about it in Amos. We're going to read about it in Joel. We see it throughout. Edom is always mentioned. Jeremiah, we're going to read it in Ezekiel tonight. And so they're mentioned more than any other nation other than the superpowers that were obviously more dominant. There are no quotes from the book of Obadiah in the New Testament. So no one goes to the book of Obadiah for a quote. Like, you know, there's no go-to place there. We'll come back and look at the outline here in a minute. Go to that first page. I've got some things that were similar, and we're going to look at there's similarities in Obadiah between Jeremiah. We read Jeremiah last week, those references there, chapter 49. And we saw some things that were just like almost parallel. And that's interesting when we start this book. Looking at Obadiah verse 1, the vision of Obadiah. This is what the sovereign Lord says about Edom. Then it says, we have heard a message from the Lord. And when it says we, you got to kind of wonder, is that just a poetic we? Or, you know, God has given Obadiah a message for us, the people. Or is that the company of the prophets? You know, is it, you know, Jeremiah, Obadiah, and they would have been alive at the same time. Ezekiel, all three of them were alive at the same time. And so were they in some kind of, you know, or are they all referring to another source? And that's one of the things that's going to come up in the discussion, is you've got similarities to Joel, you've got similarities to Amos. And so the question, this is just in passing, is Obadiah copying Jeremiah and Amos and Joel, or are they all copying Obadiah? Or is it just because of the inspiration of the Spirit that they're all saying similar things? Or is there another source that they're all drawing from? But you can admit, when we looked at Jeremiah last week, after we read through Obadiah, how the verses were like, it's the same, you're talking about the thief, talking about the stars. They're talking about the same illustrations are being used. So somehow there's a connect. I mean, you can say, well, it was inspiration by God. Okay, you can go there. But more likely, there's a common text somewhere. And it may give us some clues as far as when we start dating the book of Joel, which I've got dated later, is Obadiah in 586 is writing his work. Now Joel would be then drawing from Obadiah, as he does, I think, from others, you know, Isaiah, Jeremiah, using similar references. So anyway, that's just some things to look at. I do want to go, just as we go through this, we're going to read Psalm 137. We read Jeremiah 49 last week, and then I want to go to Ezekiel. But go to Psalm 137. I think next week we'll look at a couple other psalms, possibly, that refer to the Edomites being involved with 586 with the people of Judah. I'm in chapter 137 of Psalm, and the verse we're looking at is verse 7. But we're going to start in chapter 137, verse 1. And this is written by the Jews in Babylon, it would appear. And you're familiar with this. Chapter 137, verse 1. By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept. So this is after 586 and probably before 539. So it's during this time period it's being written, because they're early enough that they remember being in Zion or Jerusalem in the temple. And they remember the songs, they remember the festivals. So again, it's probably more towards 586 than it is towards 539. But here we go. By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. Now there's a specific reference. Zion in that text is talking about Jerusalem or the Temple Mount or Mount Moriah. It's not talking about, you know, heaven, because they don't remember heaven. They've never been there. They're remembering Zion. Probably, you know, the community, the city, the Temple Mount. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Again, their harps are probably the harps from the temple. They brought them along. You can even see in the Assyrian depiction of the fall of Lachish, inscribed on Sennacherib's palace walls, you can see the carts being taken away with the women driving the carts with the children in the carts, loaded up with stuff, Jews from Lachish, on their way to a dispersion, onto the way to Assyria, and the men walking along carrying stuff. I mean, they've carved, these are, they on one part of the scene, they're attacking the city. Then on the back side of the city that is carved in the rock carving that's on the wall, you can see, what are these? They've got carts, and they got horse or ox pulling and they seem to just like go, well, they're being transferred. And so even in there, you can see stuff like, you know, musical instruments or whatever they've got that they are taking along. So when they took these people, they didn't always just, you know, chain them up and just march them. They would load up their stuff. You are moving here. Get your stuff, you know, and load up. You know, think Beverly Hillbillies. But nonetheless, so they took their harps. So these harps may have been used in the temple or would have been used in Jerusalem, in Zion, before the fall. And they got transferred just like the gold goblets and articles got taken from the temple. So these harps came along with them. We hung our harps on the poplars, for there our captors, the Babylonians, asked us for songs. What songs? Some of those we hear these songs. You have you're skilled. Let's play some of this music. It's the Jewish style music. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. We want to see hear your festive songs. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? We can't sing joyful songs with our harps here. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. You almost got to think this is one of the priests or one of the Levites that plays in the band, similar to what Habakkuk, you know, for the stringed instruments in the temple. These would be the guys that were the band that were playing those songs. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. So they were playing the instruments. They were singing. If I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. Now that's just kind of the index what's going on. Now what is on their mind right there? We don't want to sing these songs of joy. We're in a foreign land. We want to go back to Jerusalem. Verse 7. Remember, O Lord, or Yahweh, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. O daughter of Babylon, doomed to destruction. Now, notice how that they're talking about the captives. They're talking about being in Babylon. They're talking about their musical instruments. They're thinking about things that are important to them, that are in the front of their storyline. And right there in the middle of their storyline is what? Those Edomites. When we were falling, Edom was right there. So that's a little snapshot of how the Jews felt about their... They don't want to sing their songs. They don't want to play their harps in Babylon. Then they're going to go off and talk about Babylon, who's doomed to destruction. But before they get to Babylon, there's a sentence there saying, the Edomites, man. I mean, so it was a monumental event. The Edomites weren't just the side note in history. They were part of this destruction. Remember, O Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. Now, that's not necessarily that they were just standing in the background cheering from Edom. They weren't necessarily, you could say, well, they're down here just saying, yeah, keep going. They're watching the news, cheering on, you know, from a distance. Or were they up here involved in it, and they themselves were actively participating in, let's tear this down. Let's keep working. Now, again, you can make a decision as you go. Were they actively involved? We know they're actively involved in some things down here, and there's other reference of them being up there in Jerusalem during the destruction. I'll just finish the chapter, 137. O daughter of Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is he who repays you for what you have done to us, he who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks. So as they, there's two verses there, or two mentions. One is Edom and Babylon. Edom is pronounced, is judgment is pronounced against Edom, and judgment is pronounced against Babylon side by side there for the destruction of Jerusalem. It doesn't just go off on a long tangent about Babylon. Edom gets almost as much press as Babylon does in that verse. And that verse, that is written, I'm assuming, in Babylon by someone that did the march to Babylon. They remember Zion. They took their stuff with them. And now their captors say, hey, play some music for us. We want to dance. And they're mad at Babylon, and they're mad at Edom. So that's interesting. Go to Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter, we'll start in 25. Just getting something, because what Obadiah is like we saw last week in Jeremiah 49. Basically, Jeremiah 49 is the book of Obadiah. But yet, you don't even know Jeremiah 49 is in Jeremiah, because there's so much material, and he's talking to so many different nations. Then there's that little section about Edom. It's like, oh, well, just turn past it. Then you get to the book of Obadiah. It's as long as that chapter, but it stands alone as its own book, which is interesting because remember, or kind of get this concept to think about this, we don't have, I mean, this is not just everything the Jews wrote from the days of Abraham up until the time they canonized Scripture. This is everything the Jews wrote. Now, you got to imagine there's volumes that they didn't put in here. There's prophecies that were given that were lost or weren't kept, didn't come to pass, they weren't interested in. or things they were interested in that just didn't qualify for being in Scripture. But yet, the book of Obadiah made it through all the sifting, made it through all the time. It got tacked on with, along. It's like there's many times, how many times over, you know, a period of hundreds of years did they have this collection of writings? And these, they say, okay, these we got to keep. These, put them in the box over there. But these are the ones we're going to keep. We're going to keep Jeremiah. We're going to keep Ezekiel. Who's this guy? I don't know who this, what, I don't know. Or, you know, I'm being facetious. They knew who it was. But they know that's not. But, yeah, Obadiah, let's put that here. It didn't go in the box. It went in the scroll. And yet it's, everything that's in Obadiah is basically in Jeremiah. And nothing's quoted in the New Testament, but yet it stands alone as that short little book. It's just intriguing on who and how many people protected it and kept it there. Maybe because there was such anger or animosity towards Edom that they wanted to keep this. You know, the other ones they could set aside. Again, I understand. It was inspired by God, and God was overseeing it. But what was the thought process of the Jews that God was using to keep this book here? Anyway, Ezekiel 25. In Ezekiel 25, and here's a classic example. In Ezekiel 25, you've got, starts a prophecy against Ammon, Moab, Edom, and then Philistia. So it goes right around here. They start Ammon, Moab, Edom, Philistines. And they go right through that. He prophesies. And it's all in one chapter. Now, here's the one. Here's what Ezekiel says in chapter 25. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I'm in chapter 25 of Ezekiel, verse 12. This is what the sovereign Lord says. Because Edom took revenge on the house of Judah and became very guilty by doing so, therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Okay, so Edom thinks they're getting revenge. And they became very guilty because they should have had enough sense not to do this. Like the wisdom would say, there's certain things you don't do because you may gain an advantage by stealing something, but what you do is going to come back and you know, the world calls it karma. But it's retribution, it's payback. What you sow is what you're going to reap. And Edom should have had enough sense not to do this. But they did it, and because they should have known, their guilt is very severe. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says, I will stretch out my hand against Edom and kill its men and their animals. That's interesting. I will lay it waste, and from Teman to Dedan, they will fall by the sword. I will take vengeance on Edom by the hand of my people Israel, and they will deal with Edom in accordance with my anger and my wrath. They will know my vengeance, declares the sovereign Lord. Now, it says, by the hand of Israel. Now, how, you know, Israel at this time is in captivity. Well, Ezekiel's writing before 586. And, because he's going to write after. In the very next chapter is in the 11th year on the first day of the month. That would be, that's 587. So chapter 26 is 587. So it's a year before, if it stays in context there, it's a year before. But nonetheless, chapter 35, this is a little bit longer. Ezekiel 35, chapters, verses 1 through 15. And this whole chapter now is about Edom. And do notice where this goes right after chapter 35. Chapter 35 leads into chapter 36. There's a prophecy to the mountains of Israel. In verse 26, it says, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I'll remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh, and I'll put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. That's Ezekiel basically stating the new covenant that is in from Jeremiah 31. At about the same time, Jeremiah is talking about the new covenant that we're studying in Hebrews on Sunday. Ezekiel's saying the same thing. I'm going to do something to you. That's chapter 36. Chapter 37 is the Valley of Dry Bones, where the bones come back together. They stand up. They become an army. It's like the nation of Israel coming back out of death. And then chapter 38 is the prophecy of Gog and Magog. And chapter 38 and 39. And chapter 40 is now you're talking about the millennial temple. So things are moving. After chapter 35, you start talking about to the mountains of Israel and about a new covenant. Chapter 37, the nation's coming back from the dead. Chapter 38 and 39, they're being invaded, possibly the Battle of Armageddon or something. And that leads into the millennial temple. So it's just interesting where this chapter is placed. It's right up at the end before Ezekiel leaves from talking about the destruction of nations and all the contemporary issues, and starts talking about some future events. But here it is, chapter 35. Some people, I'll just throw this out there. I don't think this is true, but it's something that, because someone has said it, you know, when some scholars or a series of scholars have said it, it's like, what are they seeing? You say, that's not what I see, but they see Obadiah. Like I'm saying, it's 586. They came up here and helped do this, and now this destruction is taking place. And I've already showed you historically how they decline. Some people think, scholars think, it's a prophecy of the future, that it isn't over yet, that there's still the judgment coming on Edom, and what they did is still a prophetic event. Now again, there may be a similar situation, but anyway, keep that in mind. I don't think that's the case, but some do, so it's worth saying, well, put that on the shelf. Chapter 35, the word of the Lord came to me, Ezekiel says, Son of man, set your face against Mount Seir. And you can see Mount Seir is right in here. Again, I don't have much left on the map right here, but these mountains right here where Petra is part of, or Selah, this is the mountain range. I am against you, Mount Seir, and I will stretch out my hand against you and make you a desolate waste. I will turn your towns into ruins, and you will be desolate. Then you will know that I am the Lord. Because you have harbored an ancient hostility and delivered the Israelites over to the sword at the time of their calamity, the time their punishment reached its climax, therefore, as surely as I live, declares the Sovereign Lord, I will give you over to bloodshed, and it will pursue you. So again, I think that happened in 586. But again, is this a future event, especially where it's tucked up against chapter 36 and 37? Since you did not hate bloodshed, bloodshed will pursue you. I will make Mount Seir a desolate waste and cut off from it all who come and go. I will fill your mountains with the slain. Those killed by the sword will fall on your hills and in your valleys and in your ravines. I will make you desolate forever. Your towns will not be inhabited. Then you will know that I am the Lord. So this is apparently Ezekiel writing after these events took place. I mean, he may be prophesying out in front of before Edom did these actions, but it seemed like he's heard the report of what took place when Jerusalem fell, and he's announcing to Edom, you should not have done that. Similar, Jeremiah says it. The whole book of Obadiah is about that. Verse 10, because you have said, these two nations and countries will be ours, and we will take possession of them. So that's their thinking. We're going to take Judah and Israel. They're going to be ours. And we'll get Jacob's inheritance. We'll get our inheritance back. Therefore, as surely as I live, declares the Sovereign Lord, I will treat you in accordance with the anger and jealousy you showed in your hatred of them, and I will make myself known among them when I judge you. Then you will know that I, the Lord, have heard all the contemptible things you have said against the mountains of Israel. You said, they have been laid waste and have been given over to us to devour. Babylon laid them waste, and now we can pick them up and devour what's ever left. You boasted against me and spoke against me without restraint. Probably something to the effect of, well, now where's their God? You know, where he's Yahweh, he's the powerful God of Jacob. They sang all these songs about Zion, and now where's their God? Taken over by the Babylonian gods. And he says, you were saying those things about me without restraint, not knowing I was judging my people with an intention to bring them back. And now because you do not know me, I'm going to make myself known to you. And I heard it, he says. This is what the sovereign Lord says. While the whole earth rejoices, I will make you desolate. Because you rejoiced when the inheritance of the house of Israel became desolate, that is how I will treat you. You will be desolate, O Mount Seir, you and all of Edom. Then they will know that I am the Lord. So again, you can see a theme from Psalm, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and now we go back to Obadiah. And again, that's what the book is about. Again, it seems it's a small book, and I hope you're not, you know, annoyed, because we could blow through the book of Obadiah, and there it is. But it seems, as you look at this and let this springboard into the rest of the writings of this time period, that it was a big deal. It's not a big deal for me. I mean, and you know, I've never really spent much time in Obadiah, and the average Christian. I mean, look, this is Obadiah in my Bible, one page. And it's like, if you're going to stump somebody in a Bible quiz, or have somebody that's do a Bible race, who can turn to the book of Obadiah first without using their table of context, it's like, but yet it seems like in 586, during that time period, Edom was, and what took place here, was a big deal. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Joel and Amos refer to it. Obadiah, the whole book is about that, and the Jews kept it in the context of their scriptures. All right, I'm turning the page and looking on page 2, and we'll just do a quick outline. I know we looked at it last week. I want to teach through the verses, but here's an outline, and then I want to show you another possible model for it as how it can be read. It's got this outlined here. Edom's coming judgment. That's verses 1 through 9. The introduction of the oracle, the prophecy. And then three things. The breaching of Edom's defenses is described. We're going to take your defenses down. The plundering of Edom's treasures. We're going to take all your stuff. And then the destruction of Edom's leadership. You're going to have no government left. So one, you'll have no defense. We're going to take all your stuff. And all your administrator, all your government is eliminated. Why? That's part 2. Edom's crimes against Judah, verses 10 through 14. So they describe what kind of judgment is coming in three specific areas. Then why do you get that judgment? Well, the statement of the charge is in verse 10, and we've read it. We'll read it again. And then the explanation of it, a little more detail. Here's the charge. This is what we say you're guilty of. And then the next verse, 11 through 14, gives the details of what you did. So here's the three main punishments we're going to give you because you did this. What do you mean we did this? Because here, 1, 2, 3, these are the things you did that mean you're doing this. And then the third part, now the restoration of Israel's sovereignty. Again, that whole idea that Edom's coming down because they rejoiced with the fall of Israel, thinking Israel was gone. But you misread that. Israel's not gone. Israel's being disciplined to be brought back to fulfill the Abrahamic covenant. And so it's probably more than just rubbing salt in their wound. You're going to go down, but Israel's coming back. It's probably more about the intentions of God. Meaning, what happened to Israel, that's between me and Israel, God's saying. But you're going too far. I'm going to have to eliminate you because I am bringing Israel back. And that's what, again, the restoration. The judgment of Edom and the nations is mentioned in verses 15 through 18. And then the occupation of Edom by Israel, verses 19 to 21. And you've got to believe that the book of Obadiah, during the Maccabees, when the Hasmoneans came down here and started occupying the land of Edomia, and they had wars back and forth and forced them to become Jews, helped them, force them to become members of their community religiously, that they thought they were fulfilling that right there, that they're going down here and occupying it, that they thought, well, that we're doing the right thing because that's what we're supposed to do. And if you remember, King Herod Agrippa II, and Paul talks to him in the book of Acts, and they listen to Paul teach. And Paul says to him, I know you're very familiar with the law. He talks to him because Herod Agrippa, that it'd be Herod's grandson, was very was very much a Jew. I mean, he was an Edomite, but he was very religious. He followed the customs of, he tried to be a good legal Jew. And so Paul was talking to him on those bases. And that's well known in the other, like even Josephus writes that. Okay, now, that's the general outline. And one of the things that is, one of the commentators says, it's possible that the book of Obadiah follows a covenant lawsuit form used in the ancient Near East that would look something like this. Meaning, again, I don't recognize, I don't just read that, oh, this looks like, but if you're familiar with the ancient Near East, the legal customs, and you've read their documents, you see in here a pattern that matches their legal, just like we have a certain, like you can watch a show or a movie that they have like a legal case, a lawsuit, there's a lot of court action, and there's certain things you're just familiar with. They have certain things we do in a trial. Well, this would fit the description, and here's how it would go if it were an actual court document or a violation. It's a grievance that you have violated a treaty. And that's going to come up in this book. Obadiah is going to, or the Lord through Obadiah is going to tell them that you're going to trust nations that are going to deceive you and betray you. So you think you're mighty. They could stand alone, but they had treaties. But part of those treaties are going to be the reason they're going to trust people, and they're going to end up getting overrun by the very people they trusted, which is part of the retribution, because you did this to Judah. Well, all your treaties are going to fall apart, and you're going to be taken over. Well, here it is. If Obadiah is a covenant lawsuit, I mean, they're filling out basically the paperwork and going to court. One, it has the title. That's verse 1. And then in verse 1 also, there's the description of the scene of the judgment. This is what the sovereign Lord says about Edom. We have heard the message from the Lord. An envoy was sent to the nations to say, rise up and let us go against her for battle. So that's interesting. A messenger is sent. Now, is that figurative, or is there actually someone is sending a letter of notice to Edom, their leaders? Like Jeremiah, his letters, when you have those sections of Jeremiah prophesying to Moab and Ammon, one of two things happen. Well, one of three things. He could have just wrote them down, put them in the scroll, and no one ever saw them. Or he wrote them down and gave them to someone who was going to go over to Ammon, and they would have handed it to the leadership. Here's a message from the Lord through Jeremiah the prophet. And they would have read it, and it might have shaken them in their boots, kind of like what Jonah did to Nineveh, a kind of what Jeremiah did with his scribe's brother, Baruch's brother, Sariah. Sent him to Babylon with the prophecy and had him read it over Babylon and then tie a rock on it, throw it into the river. If that's what he did with the Babylonian prophecy, we're safe to assume he made contact with the other nation. He didn't just write the letter and just throw it away somewhere, hide it somewhere. He may have sent someone with it. Another case we see when we were teaching the book of Jeremiah, we saw this, is they'd come with the envoys, ambassadors had come over to meet with the king of Judah, and at that time Jeremiah sent them letters. He was prophesying while they were in town. He was writing the prophecies. So they may have just, here's yours, you know, handed them out to him. Baruch could have went and handed it to him. But anyway, when it talks about envoy right there, an ambassador, a messenger was sent to all the nations. That's exactly what it would be. The covenant lawsuit would be this. You'd send out, here's the message, and it would be connected. Describes the scene of the judgment. The speech by the judge. That's chapter verses 2 through 21. The speech by the judge, the three sentences. The first sentence is chapter verses 2 through 4. The second sentence, verses 5 through 7. The third sentence, those are the crimes. We are accusing you of this, and this. These are the things you've done. And then the three pronouncements of guilt. Why do we know you're guilty? The first pronouncement in verse 10, the second pronouncement in verse 11, and the third pronouncement in verses 12 through 14. There it says, you should not look down on your brother in the day of his misfortune. Because you look down on him, that is the that is what you did wrong. And then the sentence on the nations, chapter 15. No, it was sent, the envoy was sent to all the nations. In verse 2, an envoy was sent to the nations to say, rise up, let us go against her for battle. So in other words, they're calling the nations. It's time to invade Edom. Now, at the end, the pronouncement is against all the nations. Verse 50, it says, the day of the Lord is near for all nations. So Edom is the target here, and the nations are called in. And then after they get there, it's like, okay, understand, this is your fate. You are all going to suffer the same way, and the pronouncement is made. And then the rest of the book, like always, verses 17 through 21, is the promise of restoration. In other words, this nation is guilty. Here's what they've done. Here's their punishment. And this is going to happen to all the nations. But now, let's make this right. We're going to now restore Israel back for all this violence that was done to Israel. Babylon will be judged. Edom will be judged. All these nations are judged. Okay, now the crime is atoned for, and Israel is brought back. And then you have, again, that kind of that double-edged sword, if you want to say it that way, of God calling Babylon to bring the judgment for him. But once they act it out, it's like, I'm going to have to punish you for doing that. Because, again, they were doing it. He was doing it for his purpose, but they were doing it in their own hubris, in their own arrogance. That was their own sin nature. They wanted to do this. And God says, I'm ready for you to do that, because that would work for me to punish Judah and get them back on track. So I'll let you run with your hubris. There you go. Thank you. I can use that discipline. Now, about your hubris, that arrogance, now I've got to punish you for it. And it's like, isn't he making... No. He's using the sin. He's the master builder. I mean, that's why Satan, it's like, I would lock Satan, and we've talked about this before, I would lock Satan up. If I was God, I would get rid of Satan. But God said, wait. This is all going to work out. This is all going to balance out. Satan is deceiving. People want to be deceived. I can use all this. And in the end, I'll judge all the sin, but I'll gain a crop of people who've grown out of it and have come to me. And so that's that ideal of everything works out for the good of those who trust the Lord or who love the Lord or are walking with the Lord. And sometimes it can almost seem contradictory, but again, if I can say it this way, it's almost like playing, multi-level chess. If you're just looking at this plane, it's like it looks unfair, but God is up here playing on another level, using all the parts that are moving down here to achieve his purpose that he's moving up here for an ultimate. So all things work together for the good of those who love the Lord. Now, Edom didn't love the Lord, so they're going to get judged. Babylon didn't love the Lord. They're used by the Lord. And that explains, like we've talked before, that explains what was going on with Judas. I mean, Jesus is God. He knows all, and he chooses Judas to be his disciple, and then Judas betrays him. It's like, didn't you see that coming? Well, yeah, he saw it coming, but it's like, this will all work out, and there we have that. So that's what I've got for tonight. I think next week we're going to actually get into, going through the verses. You kind of see the outline and how it fits together. You kind of got a feel for it. The first 17 verses are about Edom. The last verses are about the restoration. And again, you got to keep thinking, when this takes place. But I'm going to act as if it takes place, that Edom was wrong in 586. Everybody's talking about it. Again, I can't emphasize that enough. Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Obadiah, Amos, Amos was talking about another event, but he mentions Esau or Edom also. But they're all talking about this event. The Psalms. They're writing a psalm about their harps and playing music, and it's like two things they say. Edom and Babylon, you're doomed. It's like, you got us over here wanting us to play harps over here in Babylon, and that's right out of Psalm. There's other psalms, too, that will mention it. Okay, that's what we're talking about tonight, and next week we'll start going through verse by verse through that. Do you guys have any thoughts or questions? And don't forget, this was the Christmas message. Right.
If we can take a long visit over that area, is it literally desolate to this day? Are there any cities? Is there any prosperity happening there at all?
Yeah, I can't answer that, but you can see it's mostly, the Negev, and it's just, it's barren land. Then you could also push that into this area. Is going to be burning in sulfur forever. This is going to be a desolate wasteland. The prophets talk about that also. And it's interesting because this is where Sela or Petra right here. I'm sorry about my map. But that is where the 144,000 go. When they go out here to hide, and Satan pursues them. But the Antichrist has no authority in this area here. He can't. Ammon, Moab, and Edom, this area right here, Jordan and Saudi Arabia, in this, the Antichrist, I mean, they flee to the mountains from Jerusalem. They flee to the mountains. And then the Lord comes back striding forth from Edom, from Bozrah, in glory. And Isaiah, it's like, so again, just like we talked about in Habakkuk, the Lord is coming from this area. And so, there's several pieces there. That desolate forever, and then it's going to be burning. There's going to be a fire. There's going to be wasteland. Gog and Magog. This will be the burial place over here on the east side of the Dead Sea. It's really going to all the bodies will be collected and thrown over there. So that'll be the burial of the horde. It's the Hebrew translation of that or something. It definitely is, because it says that, but I think it's two events. I think so. Now, some people put those two together, because Gog and Magog, two times, must be Gog, same event. But it certainly seems to me like two different events. But yet, Gog and Magog would represent the nations or the powers of the nations. And just like Satan is going to do his work at the end or during the tribulation, be locked up, then come back and do it again. I mean, you've got a repeat. So I don't have any trouble saying those are two separate events, because you're saying, well, he's locked up. Well, now he's back. Well, yeah, Gog and Magog is defeated, but 1,000 years later, the nations rise up and try to do the same thing. I think those are two different events. What I do think that I've made an adjustment on is I'm really thinking Gog and Magog in Ezekiel, that ties into Armageddon. I've tried to put that even in Hope for America's Last Generation. I've got that happening before the rapture. And when I wrote Hope for America's Last Generation, I was still pre-trib. So I've got, there's a possibility that Gog and Magog would set up the what I said there, and I'll stop, that Gog and Magog, they're coming in to invade Israel. That's like the Antichrist coming in, and they're destroyed. And then he leaves, and they get the Temple Mound. He goes back west, regroups, and after 3.5 years, comes back stronger, drives them out. That scenario. That makes sense. But when we've read it several times, like on Monday night and different places, like when I read it, it just sure sounds like Armageddon. So that's what I think. Any other thoughts? And you know better than to say anything. So I'll pray. And a Merry Christmas, and we will have class next week. This kind of falls in the sweet spot. We just kind of Christmas and New Year's, and we get teachers. We get a week off next week. We get all next week off, and I get off Thursday and Friday this week. Tony's off tomorrow, so I get a week and 2 days. But I was projecting out, looking at spring break, and I get Friday off and a whole week. So Christmas break is only 1 day more than spring break. So it's like, I'm looking forward to spring break already, so I'll pray. Father, we do thank you again for the chance to be here. We thank you for your word. We thank you for a chance to study these things. We do ask that it would be more than just information, but it also help transform our hearts, keep our eyes sharp and focused on you, and do thank you again for the good things you've done for us and that you have planned for us, and ask that we may understand them and share them with other people. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you for being here.